Well, hi, everyone. It's really good to be back for another campfire conversation. It's been a little while. Last week we didn't do one because John and Sam and I were, and most of, a lot of base camp were at Bear Trap Ranch, just west of Colorado Springs, at the base camp gathering, which was a great event. I hope you saw the video that I had up. I've taken it down, and I put up the trailer for the movie that we're going to be discussing tonight. So I hope you see the trailer. I hope you get on the link and find out more about this movie. And, of course, we're going to be talking about this now. But this is really fun, what we're going to do tonight. So Kevin DeVries is our guest. He is also a base camp member. He came to the calling retreat back in 2012 in the Minneapolis area. So, Kevin, this is really good. I'm glad you initiated this with us by emailing us and offering yourself to do this, and a lot because it's very time-sensitive, being that this film that you are a part of is going to debut a week from today nationwide. So, first of all, thanks for, you know, aggressively reaching out for us and telling us about this and then doing this with us.
Great. I'm just really happy to be here, to be honest with you. It's just a great privilege.
Okay, so as we'll get into this, because I'm very curious about this movie, your place in it, and Kevin allowed John and I to, and Sam won't be able to join us tonight because he's actually doing a calling, or not a calling retreat, he's doing a retreat based on his book that he's written that will come out formally a year from now, but it's on hearing God in conversation, so that starts tomorrow for him. But Kevin gave us the ability to watch a pre-screening of his movie, and it was great. John and I both really enjoyed it, and we'll talk about this more, but we encourage you to watch it. But before we start talking about that, Kevin, just kind of give us a little bit of your story, because we all understand the power of story, and to understand something that's going on, you have to understand its context. So just give us a little bit about your story, who you are.
Yeah, well, I stumbled into the Finding Noah story that will be all over the place in October the 8th, which is a week from today. I read an Associated Press article that shouldn't have gone live, and it was about a professor in Lynchburg, Virginia, at the Liberty University that was leading an expedition to look for Noah's Ark on top of Mount Ararat. And at that point, I had climbed 5 of the 7 continental summits, and I'd skied to the North Pole. I was trying to do this particular goal of what they call the Explorer's Challenge, which is to ski to both the North and the South Pole and then also climb the 7 continental summits. So I had all this high altitude, extreme weather conditioning and experience, and I thought, boy, a lot of these guys are probably going to be, you know, from states where they're not used to ice or snow, period, and they're living at sea level, and I know they want to find something, but my hunch is they probably have no clue as to what they're getting into, and that proved eventually true as time progressed. So at first they're like, well, we've already got a mountaineer, and we're doing great, so thanks, and then it kind of went silent for a while, and then within 30 days of departure, they emailed me back, and they just said, hey, we're not sure if and this other mountaineer has turned out to be one of my best buddies, Hull Condren. He may be on tonight. But we both eventually ended up going together. But it worked out great because then both of us were there for that first year, which quite honestly was one of the most difficult years we had on that mountain because we really didn't, even with preparation, things went south really quick. So prior to joining that, so that's 2009, to even rewind the tape further back, I was involved in ministry for about 10 years. I served as a youth and young adult director at a number of different churches and then also became a national consultant for a particular denomination, specifically for young adult ministries and trying to help denominations or congregations be able to reach out to the postmodern generation because the basis of understanding with postmoderns is entirely different. Actually, it's really no precedent for in church history, so we were trying to reach out to young adults. Mm. And then I had a situation happen in my marriage at that time, and it just it exploded, and it really took the wind out of my sails for about the next decade and a half. And I had several people counsel me to get into counseling, to get into therapy, because the way that whole situation unraveled, it just it really added layers of shame to my life. And I, of course, blew it off. It was almost like a Monty Python, you know, the scene where the guy is trying to pass, and who is it, the Black Knight, you know, he keeps hacking off all of his limbs, and he's basically just saying, ah, it's a flesh wound, you know, and blood's coming out everywhere, and he's just hobbling on his stumps, but he's still going to fight the guy, right? So I kind of, and a lot of guys were like that. It's just a flesh wound, you know. But in reality, it was deep. It was severe, and it was infected, and it was inflamed with lies, and those lies basically had no place to go, and so they became my belief system. I got remarried and basically dragged all those wounds, all those lies back into a second relationship. And you can kind of see where, you know, that ends up going. And so it really wasn't until after the collapse of that relationship, and that actually happened simultaneously when I went to Heart Revolution. I felt as if when I came there, I mean, I had talked to Kevin Miles, who's probably on, and big shout out to Kevin and the guys that go the distance, because they have protected me from me over the last 3 years. So kudos to them for giving me a community to tell my story and not be owned by it anymore. But I came to Heart Revolution. It was in the Twin Cities area, actually just outside of it. You were the speaker. I'd asked Kevin, you know, hey, who's this Gary Barklow guy? And this book looks really good. And should I go? And he's like, dude, by all means, go. And I'd only known Kevin for a couple of weeks. I just missed his Hearts Alive and Free retreat at that time. So I came there, and it felt like I mean, I was bleeding all over, and I had this distinct sensation that the hounds of heaven had caught my scent, because I was leaving blood everywhere. And also, conversely, and in addition to that, the hordes of hell were right there by their side. So I felt like I was just this fugitive. I was a wanted man. I jumped in my truck. I drove 800 miles to the Twin Cities area, and I just kind of bled all over the place that weekend. Four guys, you know how the structure goes, because obviously you've designed it, but it's just a stroke of genius what you guys do in those particular weekends of getting guys to speak into each other's lives in a non-hokey, non-King James funky way. It's legit. These guys are being Christ and speaking Christ into your life and speaking grace. And so these guys were saying things to me after the course of 4 days that I had only heard from God before, which was incredibly powerful to hear that out of a human mouth, whereas before that you only felt that between yourself and God, but then you doubt whether you actually heard that or if you conjured it up. But to hear it come out of the mouths of strangers, really. I'd never met these guys before. I came up alone. So that was huge for me that particular weekend. A lot of dots that I had collected over decades of ministry, and I owned several businesses and sold some of them, and some of them did well, some of them didn't do well, and years of travel and exploration. I just came to that retreat and was, for the first time, really starting to connect dots, and then just jumped right from that retreat into Go the Distance Ministries with Kevin Miles and those guys there that just killed me with kindness and loved on me, gave me a grace community to tell my story. And even after I told all of it, you know, they did the John Lynch on me. John Lynch, you know, lying on me. Is that all you got? I felt that I was, like, disqualified. I was like, Kev, you really know, you know, my story is kind of rough and raw. And so I gave him my spiel, and I thought, well, I mean, I thought he was going to refer me to a counselor, because that's typically what a lot of ministry guys do. Like, whoa, you just here's the name of a number. This guy can help you. But instead he said, well, I think you might actually qualify for our group. So it was just a whole – the script has just been flipped over and over and over again. So, you know, and then time progresses, and I go on this whole crazy five-year-long deal every summer for 5 years from 2009 to 2012, anywhere from 2 weeks to a month and a half at a time. Would go in this search for Noah's Ark, and the first 3 years I was hell-bent on finding this thing, and we had all these technical eyewitness things that were happening that seemed to converge at once. We had remote sensory intel that was telling us, hey, there's something on the mountain. The guy is an atheist. He doesn't really care what it is. He just thinks that something, I mean, he's using incredibly inflammatory language that it looks as if some structure has fallen out of the sky and has landed on top of a mountain, and it's covered in about, you know, 40 to 60 feet of ice. I mean, that's inflammatory language. So that just ignites your faith. It ignites your imagination. But he says, it's not my job, you know, to tell you what it is. It's your job to get on the mountain to figure it out. So then you've got to get boots on the ground. You've got to drag guys up there. You've got to drag generators up to 17,000 feet. You've got to set up tents and hurricane force winds. You've got to deal with electrical storms that are so intense. It feels like you've just got bees all in your hair. I mean, everything is the static electricity just charging the atmosphere, lightning's around. I mean, it almost felt like in many ways that I half expected half the time for Charlton Heston to show up and just crack the Ten Commandments over my head. I mean, it was biblical in proportion, so it was just way off the edge, crazy stuff. All my teachers, all my kids' teachers think that my kids are a bunch of liars because, you know, what does your dad do? He looks for the Ark and he goes to the North Pole, and so I have to educate them every year. Now the kids are telling the truth, and this is what Daddy does. And so, you know, finally we can put this to rest once and for all. The kids will watch the film with me. But as time progressed, so the first 3 years, I'm like, we got to find this thing. And then I began looking at all the guys that I was climbing with, and all of us come from different backgrounds, but we seem to all have some level of brokenness inside of us, you know, a part of us that either had experienced trauma, whether we're war vets. We always had vets climb with us, everybody from Navy SEALs to Rangers to whomever, for security reasons, because we're always going into this geopolitical hotspot. We're about 10 clicks away from Iran, so you just anything can happen. You've got a state-sponsored terrorist group that's your porters by day, and by night, or by day, they're your porters, and by night, they're freedom fighters, or a.k.a. U.S. state-recognized terrorist groups. So there's just a lot of intrigue and intensity that's happening there all at once. You don't know who's your enemy, who's your friend, who's lying, who's telling the truth. And then you've got all these technical eyewitnesses, remote sensory intel that we're now being confirmed with on-the-ground, ground-penetrating radar readings. So we're dragging these 100-megawatt radar units across an ice field the size of a football field, and I'm watching this in real time. It looks like a heart algorithm where you've got these static lines, and all of a sudden they're going crazy on you. And fascinatingly enough, they take on almost the same dimensions of the biblical size of Noah's Ark. So you're like, what in the world is going on here? This is crazy. You've got remote sensory guys are telling you one thing, and now you've got boots on the ground, and you've got all these anomalies that are popping up, and I'm using that word very carefully, anomalies, which is essentially something you don't know what it is. It's just there. It has no description, and you've got to drill down with either drills. You've got to get core samples, or what we did three times, which was most Herculean of all, you've got to dig these monster holes about 8x8 down to 35, 40 feet to try and figure out what these anomalies are that are appearing on the ground-penetrating radar scan. So
now,
we did
now, Kevin,
that.
Now, yep. Now, Kevin, let me tell everybody as you're telling this story, and they're fascinated by it, that all of this is seen in the movie. So they're actually going to get to see what you're talking about. So I want people to know this as you're telling us, so keep going.
Yep. Well, the film crew came in 2013, which in many ways was the calmest year that we had because it was unprecedented in that there was actually a ceasefire between the PKK, which is your friendly neighborhood freedom fighters, and the Turkish government, which uses basically the mountain as a shooting range for their tank battalion that sits at the foot of the mountain. I mean, it's just a lot of unrest there, but there was enough stuff in the film, you know, compound fractures and crazy stuff like that, and you know, there was a couple electrical storms that left a lot to be desired. So there's enough there. But some of the stuff I'm talking about may or may not be totally in the film because, you know, there's 5 years worth there and they can only splice and dice so much of the other footage. So
let me ask you this. So this is what also amazes me. Not only what you did, and as they will see in the movie, how, you know, difficult it was to climb Mount Ararat to get on the top, but you did this five times, right?
Yeah, I mean, 5 years, and it got to the point, you know, once you get acclimated, you become almost Sherpa-like. So it usually took me about 4 days to get guys from, you know, 3,000 to 4,000 foot level. Actually, our base camp, which is more of a campground, was at about 5,500 feet, so about Denver's elevation. But to get them up to 17K, our dig site, excavation site, was at 16,800. That usually was about a four-day process. But once you get acclimated, at the very end, I could do it in 24 hours. If I didn't have anybody with me and I needed to get supplies up and down. So I don't know how many times I was up and down that mountain. I mean, it was a lot. And I don't have, even though I was a lead mountaineer, the real story are the guys that this is their first mountain and they're way out of their league and they know it and they're scared and they feel like they're going to the moon. Those are the guys you want to put on camera. I'm kind of boring because it's like, you know, are you scared? Well, I mean, kind of, but if I'm scared, then everybody else freaks out. So you have to kind of play, and they did that very well throughout the film of interplaying some you know, different personalities, and the guys that really got some very good face time, and rightly so, were those that were just like, what in the world have I gotten myself into?
Right.
Because I think that's the story of every man. You feel like you're jumping into your story, you're 40 minutes late, the film is already playing, you can play every part except your own, and so you just feel like you're not even part of your story. So I think a lot of people will really feel like, you know, that's the guy I feel like. I feel like the dude that just is totally out of his league. His gyroscope is spinning. He's disorientated. He has no coordinates, no visual. So I think in the movie, people really recognize that. But anyway, the first 3 years, let's find the arc. And then the last 2 years, the script again got kind of flipped on me because I began to less and less believe that it was about so much a boat, and it became more about a brotherhood. But even more particular for me, it became about finding home and healing. I had all kinds of counselors and friends tell me, dude, you got to find your home address. You got layers of trauma here. We can look into your eyes, and you're anywhere but here. You're either way in the past, full of regret, or you're way ahead in the future, thinking about your next trip, even while you're experiencing your current trip, but you're not here. You may have a house, you may or not have a house, which is my current living status, but it doesn't matter. You're just not home. You haven't found your home address yet. So I had to figure out, how do you go about that? And so all of a sudden, the mountain took on this emblematic tone to it, where instead of just climbing a mountain, I was climbing into my pain. And fascinatingly enough, it's almost like an encryption that you're breaking. The mountain we were climbing in the Turkish language is Agri Dağ, which simply means the painful mountain. We're drilling these huge excavation holes into the ice, trying to extract a treasure. All of a sudden, things started clicking. It's like, you know what? This is almost like a Lonely Mountain, Lord of the Rings, Hobbit kind of thing, where we're just these wandering dwarves. We're stunted in our stature. We've lost our nobility. We've lost our homeland. Some dragon came in and just scorched the earth, went into the sacred places of our heart, you know, raped and pillaged wherever it wanted, which is the nature of fear, and then we're just left wandering these wastelands, and all we can do is weep, and we're almost like the Jewish people that, you know, hung their harps on the poplars along the streams, and there's no more singing, there's no more song. We just go about, and we're these vagabonds, and we're dwarfish in our nature. We've lost our strength, our height, our nobility. We're nameless. And we're just wandering this wasteland, and we just can't find home. We can't get back to the Lonely Mountain. We can't get back and face Smog and take that treasure back. So I just became really, really determined to, A, find home. And my process has been a sacred scandal through a very series of perfect storm events. I came off the mountain in 2013, and instead of going into a house somewhere, I went from a tent into my truck. And essentially, I've been there ever since. And I tell people, it's very unusual, but there is precedent. You know, you've got guys like Joseph, who had to live in a prison to find his, you know, passage to the palace. You have Paul, who spent most of his life living as a fugitive, but wrote two-thirds of the New Testament. Guys like Bunyan, who wrote, you know, the greatest book outside of the Bible as far as publication value with Pilgrim's Progress, and then Dante's is exile, and he writes, you know, this incredible epic poem, and the list goes on and on. John Milton, you know, with Paradise Lost, and Bonhoeffer, and so good things happen in dark days. I always tell people, I believe the real lamps of God are always lit in dark and cold caves. So David's got to go on the run for 16 some odd years, even after he knows who he is. He's already anointed. He's got to go on this long, circuitous journey of basically trying to get this Saul out of himself, and he's in this cave with all these guys, and there are people that he necessarily wouldn't maybe be connected with, because after all, he's been anointed for royalty, he's supposed to be the king, and yet in this cave of Adullam, he finds his brotherhood, he finds his name, and these guys are the ones that he takes with him into the kingdom. When he's coronated, this is his cabinet, and these are a band of ragamuffins. I mean, they're a band of ruffians. And so I kind of have that sense that maybe some of that is evolving with this mountain theme of just getting into your pain. I always tell people that one of the biggest things I've learned about pain is that your purpose is encrypted in pain. And if you can enter into that pain, your deepest, darkest memory, you can do the Luke Skywalker thing and jump into that cave and tear that mask off and see not only the face of your father, but see your own face and face your worst fears, you might just come out the other end of Jedi Knight. You might be another Aragorn type of guy that it goes through the paths of the dead and takes the ghosts of the paths with him and comes out the other end, and all these ghosts, all these shrouded mists, you know, these memories that you can't attach yourself to anymore, they can actually become a powerful army that you can use. And so if you find a transcendent person, you typically stumble into a person that has allowed God to use their pain to become their purpose. And then once you find your purpose, you find, you know, your power. And so by the fifth year.
I love the way you describe finding home, and I wanted to ask how much of your home did you find? How much can you verbalize about what your home is as a result of these experiences?
Well, I'm assuming everybody on this call wants to be like Christ, right? So one of the things that that's the guy I'm following. I know Gandhi lived in a goat shack, and he had a lot of transcendent things to say, but theologically I have some differences there. But Christ, now there's a guy that I could follow after. I would go to the gates of hell with Christ by my side. And for that matter, we're going to reach the gates of heaven with the same. But when I look at the life of Christ, I look at a man who came from another dimension. He came into our own and, you know, incarnated himself into human flesh to show us the meaning of suffering, to die for others. It was essentially the Trinity having to go native. It wasn't enough to be this, you know, Olympian God out there that's detached from humanity and strikes people with thunderbolts when, you know, they displease him. They had to basically take on the skin of human flesh and body that humanity and show the world the meaning of love that can suffer. And then to usher in this whole other era of grace, which is kind of like a steward, you know. Christ is the king, but I think grace in many ways is this sun-carved maiden that's really the steward of his kingdom. And so now we're living in this grace realm, and we have these rooms of grace and these kingdoms of grace, and all these wonderful things happen. But to answer your question specifically with home, for me it's just getting inside your heart. I think Christ had no place to rest his head because he was always at home in his heart. I think Christ was always present, and I think that's what drove the multitudes to him. When you meet a person that is right there, right now, the mystics, the desert fathers, and the Christian mystics talk about the naked now. I love that phrase, and Richard Rohr has really capitalized on that, where you've got this sense that of living in Pablo, who I'm sure has been a guest several times and or maybe is listening, does really well with this, of just living in the now, living in the present, because in the present is God's presence. And so for me, I had to allow God to heal wounds because the last place I wanted to hang out was my heart. So for the first 3 years looking for the Ark and then climbing all the mountains before that, I could do 18,000 feet in the snap of a finger. I could do 18,000 miles in the snap of a finger. I just couldn't do 18 inches. And if you can't do 18 inches, you have to do 18,000 miles, and you've got to do 18,000 feet because we always externalize what we can't internalize. It always works that way, and I couldn't break that algorithm. It's like, why am I doing all this stuff? Why am I always dancing with death? And it was just a way that I was trying to, you know, externalize what I couldn't internalize. I was trying to find healing and achievement, and so I think that the Ark really fed that. You know, it was a treasure. It was like Raiders of the Lost Ark. You're trying to find this treasure, and you hope you're enough of a Sir Galahad, enough purity of heart to be able to clasp this thing that those with greedy and tainted hearts can't, you know, grasp. I mean, several years we felt like we were right on the cusp of the greatest discovery in modern history. I mean, if you find the Ark, my gosh, it's just a watershed moment. It changes every ideology from, you know, anthropology to zoology. It changes everything. But now my whole motive for coming the last 2 years, and especially when the film crew was there, was like, you know what, there's something deeper here, and it has to do about brotherhood, but it also has to do about finding home and finding that place in your heart where it doesn't matter where you live, you're always home. And so I talked to a lot of guys, because I was the McMansion guy. I had a hole on the golf course, acre of land, and everything was wonderful, but man, I was just not anywhere near that place. I got a house, but I didn't have a home, and I think a lot of us confuse house with home. We think that because we have a physical structure that protects us from the elements and a place to hang our family photos and a place to nurture it. And that's a wonderful thing. We have to have those things. Those are, there's nothing wrong with that. I'll probably have another, you know, McMansion someday. Who knows? But right now, I'm very heaven bent on finding home apart from a house, because I don't want to mix those two up again. And that chapter is probably closing, and it's extreme, and it is a dramatic parable for maybe others to learn from, and I highly do not advise it. Living in the winter in your truck in Michigan is less than ideal. But fortunately, I had a negative 40 below sleeping bag from my ventures into the North Pole, so I'm all set. You know, you develop a system, and you know how to work it, and you've got your health club membership, and you can do your showers, and you can talk with these guys at the health club and act as if you're a millionaire because you were one at one time. So you know how to do that whole shtick. But in reality, you're really just, it's just funny. It's almost like I think Christ was when he just walked around and people were like, oh, can we do this for you? And can we build you a house? And can we give you a big ministry platform? And he's like, guys, what do you think? I just come from heaven. Heaven is my home. There's nothing really you can do that's going to impress me. So let's just quit all the baloney and let's just get real, take our masks off and just come to the realization that you need me. I don't really need you.
Yeah.
That's the nature of grace. Grace is this lover that, you know, is this perfect girlfriend that's only attracted to your imperfections. The minute you try to get perfect, she's unattracted to you. So just quit all the, you know, the make-believe. And so the whole mountain took on a different edge. And then the other thing that I was looking for was healing. And so, to me, I just began to see Mount Ararat as, you know what, we all are exiled kings. We're all in a foreign country. Lewis talked about this so well, that we're in a land of shadows. And I love what Martin Luther King said, that, you know, everything you see here in this dimension is a shadow of something more real in the next. And I love that whole idea that we are just going through a land of shadows. And we are these mythic mountaineers that are doing something physical, but there's a deeper dimension that's going on here that we can barely tap into. And so I was really just bent on, how do I find healing? How do I bleed this stuff out? And for me, writing has been very cathartic. There's a 200-page manuscript that I pray some editor has the courage to actually take a look at someday, that he just bled out of me over 500 days. That's a whole other project we don't have time to talk about. But for me, I had to do that. Pain became my pen, and tears became my text, and it just bled out. And maybe someday it'll have a platform and it'll minister to some people. But it's a true myth that it takes too long to explain, but those were my two things. I wanted to find home. I was sick of being in a body and not being present. I was sick of not connecting with my kids, not connecting with my wives, if I can pluralize that, and no, I'm not a Mormon. I've just been married twice. And I've learned things the hard way, you know? And
yeah,
the more
sure.
I admit where I've come from, the more people want to hear, because I think that they feel like, gosh, you know, I'm kind of there. So
yeah.
I didn't want to live like that anymore. It's not worth it.
So let me ask you, Kevin. So the last climb you did, where you had the film crew and all, that was in 2014. Is that right?
2013. So it took quite a while to go through the editing,
so,
and it was in.
So a couple years in editing. What has that been like for you? Because here you had year after year of climbing this mountain, all that you were doing, and then all the filming, and then it's over, and all of this now experience. Besides what's happening in your heart with God, all this experience is now in some editing bay somewhere in Hollywood or wherever. What has that been like for you to have that over? What these last 2 years, has that been really hard?
Well, in some ways, yes. In other ways, you know, your truck eventually, after time, it turns into a tabernacle, and that's it. I don't mean to create an overly romantic environment for that, but something transcendent happens where all the material things just kind of go away. I think the one thing that kept me sane, because I felt like at the beginning of it, I felt like the Lord was preparing me. He was just saying, look, you're going to go through a Job-like experience. It's going to be a sacred scandal, and some people will think it's because you've done something bad, and so this is God's way of doing the karma thing on you. But I want you to understand a couple things very clearly, and he was able to do this through a bunch of dramatic parallels in my life that helped bring it home to me because I'm very visual. But he basically said in a nutshell, I want you to be very careful how you view me through this and how you view yourself through this. First thing is, you are not a criminal, so this is not punitive, this is not punishment. I want you to know that you're a climber. and climbers have to descend in order to ascend. So Everest was out in the theaters, and it still is. The Russians developed this whole process where, and everybody mimics it now, where you climb high. I mean, you put your stuff up high, and then you camp low, and then you put your stuff up higher, and then you camp at that camp. So you're constantly doing this whole bury and camp type of thing. And then you get up to 25,000 feet, you get into the death zone, and you spend a night there, and then you rocket all the way down to 10,000 feet, because nothing can heal at that altitude. At 25,000 feet, if you've got a sniffle, it won't get healed. If you have no appetite, it's not going to come back. Anything that's wrong with you, nothing can heal in that thin air. So you've got to go back down, and he says, I want you to view yourself through my eyes, because like Lynch says, we have two gods, the one who is and the one who are. Shane believes he is. He said, you're a climber, and you've been up high, and it's been wonderful, and it's been transcendent, but I've got to take you down low, because there's things in you, in your heart, that has to heal, and you can't heal at altitude. You've got to get down into the valley, and secondly, I want you to look at yourself not as a prisoner, you're a patient. You are not in a cell, you are not in a jail, you are in a hospital, and when you're a patient, you can't do really anything to make yourself better. You've got to let other people come into your life that have more expertise, that have a different set of eyes, and part of that is reading your book, It's Your Call, and part of it is hanging out with the guys that go the distance. You need other people to speak into your life, because as a patient, there's really nothing you can do other than rest and relax and let the experts do the work. Mm-hmm. He said, I've had you here before when you went through your first divorce. The pain was so excruciating because I had to put that blade into you to get some other infection out. And he said, you misinterpreted what was going on. You felt pain and you thought it was punishment, and it was really about healing. And so now I see this luminous hand, and I see a good surgeon with an evil blade of divorce or bankruptcy or houselessness, whatever word you want to apply to that. But the man behind the blade is good. He's dangerously good. He's fair and fierce. He's severe and merciful. He's truthful and terrible. He's all these things all at once. But his intent is good, and it's hurting because he wants to heal me. He wants me to feel so that I can heal. The first time around, I jumped out of the operating table. And I said, enough, because the way the first marriage ended was as a disgrace, and part of it happened while I was preaching. And part of it happened while I was preaching about Noah's Ark, so I never wanted to get into a pulpit again. I never wanted to talk about Ark stuff. And so you can see how vicious the enemy was to just try and knock everything all at once. And he said, I had you here once before. I'm going to bring you right back again. I'm going to wound you twice in the same place to heal you once and for all. Hmm. And I'm telling you guys, some of you have been there. It hurts like hell, because it's meant to, because that's your healing. It hurts. And he says, I can't give you any anesthesia. I wish I could. But you've numbed yourself, you've medicated yourself with ministry, you've done an adventure, you've done all this stuff to numb this thing, and he says, you've got to feel this, and it's going to hurt, but I'm here with you, I'm going to give you a band of brothers that's going to walk you through this thing. But you have to see me through my eyes. Don't allow your shame to come here. Guilt is good. Guilt tells you you've done something bad. Shame is bad because it tells you you are bad. And he said, right. You've made mistakes. And you're taking ownership of that, but please don't misinterpret this the second time around. I'm going to give you eyes to see and ears to hear that I'm doing this because I love you, which is crazy. God allowed all that stuff to happen to Job, even though it didn't originate with him, because he was trying to heal Job of fear. Everything Job did in the first half of his life was because he was afraid that if he didn't do something, bad things would happen. And all of a sudden, all the bad things happened that he was afraid of. And then he was left alone with God before an audience of one. And then in an audience of one, God answered all of his unanswerable questions with his unquestionable self. God gave him himself as the answer. And then I think that second half of Job's life was transcendent, because now he could be good, not because he was afraid, but because of love. So when you burn through fear, what's left? I think all that's left is love. Yeah. So I'm kind of a lucky guy. A lot of the stuff that I really feared has already happened. So I'm still alive. I'm still here. I feel like the guy in Papillion. Remember the Steve McQueen's character, one of my favorite movies, you know? He was in that solitary confinement, and eventually he outlasted the French prison that he was staying in, or that they had him confined in French Guiana, and in South America, and he kept saying every day, "I'm here, you suckers, you know, I'm not going anywhere." And then they show him, you know, his hair graying and his teeth falling out, but he outlasted his prison. So I think if you can just hang with God long enough, and I don't know who this is for, but hang in there, tie a knot around that rope if you can, the dawn will come. But as my good friend Kevin Miles says, sometimes you have to quit chasing the sun, you got to turn around, you got to face the darkness, go into that dragon's mouth, steal the treasure, go into the mountain, excavate through the ice, go where the White Witch of Narnia has touched your heart and has frozen those aspects, touch those freeze-frame parts of your life that you can't touch, you know, the little boy that's wounded inside the man, and once that boy is healed, the boy can go from being a male into a man. When he goes back and he does all these things, it's wonderful, because then all of a sudden spring comes and you can hear Aslan on the move again, and you can hear, you know, the roar of the lion, the roar of the king is amongst you. And then the beautiful thing is, and this is something I never understood before, when the dawn comes, first of all, you're not chasing the sun, but when the dawn comes, you know, it's, he's got nothing to do with it. It's 100% God, because you can't make the sun come up. The sun will come up when it wants. And that's the beauty of it. And I think that when you look at the resurrection, and when you, you know, you see, you see the power of that, you realize that it was love that resurrected Christ. And you know, that's what brings dead people to life. That's what brings dead people to life. Yeah. So I think, you know, to just wind it down, to land the airplane, is love is the mountain that we climb. Love is the mountain that conquers us as we climb towards God. And so I think the whole venture for me, if I can break the encryption, if I can understand the algorithms of awe, if I can somehow grab the transcendent message out of this, it's simply that it's love. Love is knowing. You ask any great theologian, when it all comes down to, is love is knowing. It's beyond belief. It's beyond hope. It's this giant spaceship that shoots into space, and the two fuselages of hope and faith go away, because you don't need hope. You don't need faith in heaven. And when you enter into heaven, you enter into love. The being of God is love. And so I know that I'm loved right now. And,
well,
and then everything else becomes immaterial.
Right. And your life, Kevin, as we have heard it here, is a story of resurrection, of conquering, of finding life. I want to quote you here in something you said. You said, and in fact, I put it up on the chat line here for both the Secret Garden and Base Camp, where you said, "Sometimes we have to travel to the end of the earth to reach the end of ourselves and find a new beginning in God that never ends." That it's such a powerful thing. It's such a good story. Let me just jump into the less profound for a moment as we end up this call, because I know everybody's curious about this. I've seen people chat this, and that is this. So you did this. You climbed the mountain, I think, five times altogether? Five years
in a row, yep.
Okay. So what was it like? How did things change when all of a sudden kind of Hollywood entered the scene? You know, the last year, cameras, the whole thing, it was more of a production than it was, you know, an exploration. In some ways, you were serious with what you were doing, but things changed. What was that like working, dealing with that all of a sudden?
Well, first of all, the guys from Hollywood broke every prejudice and every misconstruction that I had of them. If that's a word, I may have just created a new word in the English alphabet. Misconstruing, a misconstruction, whatever. They just broke all the stereotypes. These were men of faith. It's what you would least expect. You know, I thought, oh my gosh, here comes a Hollywood crew. You know, they're going to come, they're going to make us look like a bunch of idiots, a bunch of evangelicals that are searching for this boat. You know, they're literalists, they're fundamentalists, they take the Bible for what it is. And to me, I think the Bible is everything all at once. I think it's mythical, I think it's poetical, I think it's literal. I think God has the bandwidth to take a story like the Ark, which I believe to be literal, and also have incredible poetic applications and even mythic applications, which to me, myth is simply you don't know the origin. So in that sense, God is even mythic, because we don't know his beginning. He has no beginning. He's always been there, even before time, even before eternity. He's always been there. But what it was like. You know, it was really cool to get to know these guys. They're men of faith, and they're part of this small enclave in Hollywood that wants to do things right. And so they're part of this whole movement that's taking the cinema back. It's like God got kicked out of the classroom, and he's entering into the back doors of the cinema. And it's just, there's a deluge of faith and family films that are coming out now. Finding Noah, which is, you know, something I'm personally enmeshed in, and there's many others. And so it felt kind of cool. It's like, wow, there's some really creative, very talented, very articulate people out there that are on the same page with us. So it became very clear very early on that, you know what, these guys want to tell our story. They want to make Christianity look good, because there's nothing gained if we blackball this thing and just, you know, create a distorted view of it. We don't want to make another Noah film that basically hijacks and bamboozles the Christian community, you know, with this fraudulent narrative where we hijack, you know, the biblical story for our own personal agenda. We didn't want to do that. And so kudos to the guys that were filming. Great guys. It just felt cool. But we didn't know what the finished product would be, so it was kind of like, how is this going to end up? Because when you're on the back end of it, it just feels like this tapestry, this mosaic that's really rough and coarse. And then these editing wizards, the guy's name is Jonathan and the director is Brent. And then Jonathan comes in, and he's just like this Wizard of Oz. He does all this clever stuff behind this silver curtain. And he took all this, these chunks of coal, and they just made diamonds out of it. I mean, you guys have just seen the film, and I know that I sensationalize it because I'm emotionally enmeshed in the process. But I think the final product, knowing what the raw product was like, is just, to me, beyond movie magic. It's moving, miraculous. There's something you know, tangible there where you sense that, wow, there's something really transcendent that's going on here. So it actually was a very enjoyable experience. I've become brothers with these guys. We are a band of brothers, so it's not just the ARC Explorers, but it's the film crew. I love being around these guys. There's something that happens in a man's heart when he faces life and death with another man. It bonds you like nothing else. And I think a lot of guys spend their whole life after serving in the military trying to find that again, and the best they can find is fantasy football league. I mean, that's all that's left, you know, and there's nothing there, and they don't get real, and there's no big story that they're involved in. There's no cause greater than themselves. So I miss that most about the mountain, was just the camaraderie with the film crew, with the guys.
Yeah. Okay, so one other question for me, and I've always been curious about this, with different movies. Now, you know, a lot of the movies that have so much computer-generated action and that kind of thing, and I've always wondered, what's it like for an actor to eventually see it with all the background that's put into it versus just a green screen and they're trying to imagine it? But in your case, this is all real stuff, but what was it like for you the first time you saw the edited version of this, where something you've done over all of these years in bits and pieces, even though you know they filmed the last year, what was it like when you saw this edited version, you know, edited down to, I'm guessing it's around 2 hours. So it's condensed, it's the highlights, it's woven together. What was that like for you to see that?
Well, I wept, and I'll tell you why, because I think in that moment, I'm a big metaphor guy, and this is what it felt like. It felt like what I think a lot of us think heaven is going to be like before we are able to be healed of shame in a community. We think that heaven's going to be kind of this thing. You get there, and they've got this big silver screen in front of you, and it replays all your crap and all your glory all mixed up in one. But they're not going to let you get in until the whole story's been told. You know what I mean? It's going to feature all the things that you are least proud of, all your dark memories, all your evil deeds, and then you'll get in, but not until they shame you first. It's kind of like, I'm just going to get in by the skin of my teeth, and you just feel like, you know what, I really don't deserve to get in this place. I'll put myself through the shame, and you have the sense that you're going to have to watch this film with everyone else, and then they'll be like, okay, now that we all know what's going on and everything's told, then we'll allow you in type of thing. But what happened with that premiere, we watched it in Dallas for the first time with all the film and crew and about 800 family and friends. It felt like the way heaven should be. The movie was so much better than what we deserved. It painted us in such a better light than we could ever earn. it felt like grace, really. It was a face of grace. It was like, you know what? Somebody took a lot of time to make us look way better than what we deserve. And that's the beauty of editing and splicing and dicing. And there was no CGI, really. I mean, it was just all raw footage. There was a sound narrative there, but it felt like heaven. And I thought, you know what? This is kind of cool because now I'm, again, another layer of shame comes off. And I feel like what God was saying to me was, this is just a small piece of heaven. This is what it's going to be like when you finally pass through that thin veil and you go through that portal and you enter into another dimension where death is only a door, and what you're going to see on that screen is who you really are, and it's going to be all good. And it's going to blow you away, and you're going to weep, and Christ is going to be there to wipe away your tears because it's way better than you deserve, and it's just so awesome. And you know what it is? I think we're going to see on that silver screen, I think we're going to see what God sees of us. I think that we're going to have God goggles on for the first time without any other goggles on. It's going to be pure transcendence, pure glory, and we're going to see on that screen for the first time how God really saw us. And I think it's going to blow us away. I think He's going to show us our nobility, our saintliness, all the noble things, all the original glory that we had before the shadow came. So that's how I felt about it. It was very moving.
That makes complete sense. And again, it's a great picture, I think, of what it will be like. John Hard, you did that session at the Basecamp gathering, and one of the clips you showed was from the BBC series called Doctor Who, and the specific one from about an artist. And so what I want you to do, John, real quickly, share kind of the point of that, why you showed that clip, and then how that spoke to you about the very thing that Kevin's talking about, one day when we stand before God, that kind of thing.
Yeah, this clip was from the Doctor Who episode where he actually goes back and meets Vincent van Gogh, who spent his whole life painting, and legend has it he only sold one painting in all of his life, and he thought his whole life was a miserable failure. So they bring him forward in time to 2010 and they just tell him you're going to go into an art gallery just to see the world's greatest painters and what they painted. And he's excited. He has no idea what he's getting ready to see. So they take him into the Van Gogh exhibit, and he sees all of his paintings on the wall and all these people meandering around, looking at them, taking pictures of them. And then they ask the curator at the museum, what do you think of Van Gogh? And he basically says, I think he was one of the greatest artists of all time and probably one of the greatest humans of all time. And
and going along with what Kevin has said to us, remember he said something, he was able to enter into the pain of life, but then bring the beauty out on a canvas to show the world, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So keep going.
And so when I watched that, I just thought, you know, that is a picture of heaven. And it really is like what you just said, Kevin. We get to walk into the exhibit or the movie of our life and get to see the whole redemptive thread and not only the redemptive thread, but how God used that throughout other people's lives all over the world. We really see the true impact that we had, even though in this life we often think, well, we're just failures. We really haven't accomplished much of anything.
Yeah, so I just, you know, as soon as I heard Kevin talk about his experience of watching it, which made complete sense of, because how beautiful and amazing the film is, and yet, you know, what I know from my own life, my own experience from the things I do, what I remember are all the hard, tedious, fairly unsuccessful things, you know, and yet in an edited film, you get to see the highlights, the beauty of it, so I love those two examples. So, Kevin, this has been just fascinating. Of course, we've gone 50 minutes because this is so fascinating. So do you have any final thoughts for us as we wrap up this call?
I just think, for me, the greatest discoveries in life are who finds you when you're looking for something else or what you find when you're looking for something else. And I know that's the whole axiom of it's the journey is more important than the destination. But I would just encourage guys and ladies that are listening that you know, we have this objective and we have this goal in mind, and it's this certain treasure. And for me, it was Noah's Ark, which may not relate to other people, but it's emblematic. It's a prototype of all the things that we seek, that we think that if we find that, you know, all this validation will come, and this coronation, if you will, of our efforts, this crowning effect on our lives. And I would just encourage people that I really believe that in the process of that, and it's back to Proverbs 25, verse 2 all over again, you know, how God cloaks, it's the glory of God is to cloak a matter or a thing in mystery. And it's the glory of kings to pursue that, to search. And so I would encourage people that if you want to be a queen and you want to be a king and you want to be this spiritual, noble person that is able to kick aside the savage and is able to allow this nobility to arise that I think you'll sense in the film, I would just encourage them to realize that it's a process, and somewhere in that journey, you will meet that person. And hopefully that person is God, but it could be a certain attribute of himself that he pulls out, whether it's grace or wisdom. And sometimes those things can be personified in a maiden form or in the form of a lion or whomever. I think that we have to be really sensitive and open to that process, because I think that's where that nobility comes from. It's that whole journey of getting up every day and doing the ordinary, and then you're opening yourself up to these moments, these transcendent moments that are just, you know, extraordinary. So I really believe that. I believe that the greatest discoveries are who finds you when you're looking for something else.
Yeah, that's really good. That's very good. So, Kevin, I have put up on the chat lines the different websites, whether it's a website specifically about the movie or it's the one about where to find what theaters is playing and so on. But how can we help you promote this film from now until and through October 8th? Is there anything specifically you can tell us that would really be helpful besides us going and taking our friends?
Yeah, right. Facebook posting works wonderful. Create an event on your Facebook page. That's gotten me more traction personally than anything else. Create an event on your Facebook page, and that way it pops up in Ruby's calendar that you either have to accept or decline. That's a very practical thing that you can do. I do want to accentuate the fact that this is a one night only. I know it says the journey begins on October 8th, which is kind of misleading, but it's also truthful. It is the beginning, because after that will come DVD sales, and it'll probably live on some cable channel forever, which makes me believe I should have had a better hair day when they were filming. Anyway, that's one of the reasons I kept my hat on the whole time. I was like, I can't even take this thing off. It's horrible. After 2 weeks of no shower, forget about it. But it will live on cable. It'll go into a DVD thing, and then there's some great ministry material and actually some national ministries that we're dovetailing in with that is going to augment some of the film material into their curriculum. So you'll see that come out in 2016. But I want to accentuate that this is a one night only, and this is a film that really needs to be seen on the big screen. There are films that are made for DVD and your flat screen. This is a film that needs to be seen on the big screen. I wish it was in an IMAX format, but it's not. But it's one night only, October the 8th. There's a small chance we could trigger an encore performance, but we won't even know that until after the fact. So, and then pre-purchase your tickets, too, because in many of these markets, you know, you've got 630 theaters. In some smaller markets, you may only have one theater there. And when that fills, unless there's another one open, that's it. So we really encourage people to do that. And just use your social networks. I can send e-blasts to people where it's a template. You can send it out to all your followers. It's an email. You don't have to create it. All you got to do is just plop in all your email addresses, and it's ready to go. There's Facebook posts that you can use. So there's a number of different assets that we can give people to help get the word out.
Great. And let me just say, and John and I will both agree with you, we've both seen it on, because we got the pre-screening thing that you let us see, on our flat screen. And it was great, but I'm telling you, I want to see this on the big screen. Full sound, the whole deal. So. Kevin, thank you so much for doing this. And you know what? I think we'll want to talk later, maybe in several weeks, a month and a half or something, just to see how has this gone and what have you seen from this. So thank you so much for doing this call with us. It's been great.
Gary, thank you for personally investing in my life. We didn't really know each other until this call, but your book has got its print all over me. So I thank you very much for that. And I thank you for what you're doing for men, and I believe in what you stand for. I love the title of your ministry, because to me it's the embodiment of of what we should all be after, which is our original glory, the nobility that we had, you know, before the shadow came. So thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thank you for those words. And so, everyone, thank you for being on the call with us. It's been so good. We've taken an hour instead of 40 minutes. So thank you, and hope to be back with you next week. So see everybody. Good night.
Good night.